This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I just want to welcome everyone this evening to our Osher Mini Medical School course in Optimizing Well-Being in Older Age. My name is Anna Chodos. I'm in the Division of Geriatrics, and I'm one of the course co-directors. And we do have a lot of people who'll be filtering in still, it seems like. We had wonderful enrollment for the course, so the first thing I wanted to do was just thank everyone. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your interest. And we're really, really thrilled about this course and the opportunity to interact with you. So this course is sponsored by what's called the Optimizing Aging Collaborative at the Division of Geriatrics here at UCSF. And that is a federally funded program for the moment, in bringing education to really to primary healthcare and healthcare providers, as well as to social services and social agencies and the community. And this is the community. So we're just really thrilled to be able to bring what we consider key topic areas, key areas of importance for older adult health. I also just want to introduce the whole course. So this evening, we're going to be talking about mobility and activity, hopefully with lots of energy. That's myself, Anna Chodos, and Loan Catalico, physical therapy. Next week is health benefits of staying social, connecting with your community. And this is being led by Dr. Personotto, who's a national expert in the area of social wellness and loneliness in older adults, as well as with Anne Bartoletti, who's from the Institute on Aging Friendship Line, which is a key community resource to engage older adults in the community. After that, we have some heavy medical topics, medication optimization, with John Newman from Geriatrics and Kirby Lee from our School of Pharmacy here. Thinking and Doing in Cognitive Aging and Function, which is co-led by Ann Fabini, again from Geriatrics, and Craig Wingate from the Alzheimer's Association. And our last are really put some key geriatrics principles into practice, hopefully, around using prognosis and life expectancy in making important medical decisions for you, family, anyone, really, and advanced care planning with Rebecca Sudori. I'm sorry, forgot to mention Alex Smith. He's also in our division. And then Rebecca Sudori, working on advanced care planning, she's an international expert in how to prepare to do advanced care planning and prepare to make difficult medical decisions, and she's going to be co-presenting with Sarah Huffman and Sarah Hooper from the UC College of Hastings College of Law. So they are working together in what's called a medical legal practice around advanced care planning. So I think this is going to be an incredible course. I will be here through much of it, and we're really hoping that a lot of this information is actually really practical, is applied information for yourself, family, caregivers, anyone really. And we, again, so welcome your feedback. So please keep it coming. And this is our collaborative, just to acknowledge all of our collaborators, including the major medical providers in the area of San Francisco Health Network, VA, and UC Division of Geriatrics, UCSF Medical Center, and then UC College Hastings, California Hastings College of Law, as well as community providers, so Alzheimer's Association, Little Brothers, Friends for the Elderly, volunteer organization, Homebridge, which trains in-home workers, Open House, which works with LGBT older adults, and our City and County of San Francisco Department of Adult and Aging Services, which provides a lot of in-home supportive services, adult protective services, critical services for people in the community. So thank you. All right, so we'll get started on this evening's topic, staying active at every ability level, mobility and activity. So again, I introduced myself and just wanted to mention again that Loan Catalico here is the Assistant Director of Rehabilitation here at the Medical Center. So we're going to be co-presenting on this topic. And our objectives for the evening are to really introduce mobility and activity as it pertains to the health of older adults, but also to sneak in a couple other topics that we know are very related to these things, but in geriatrics and in clinical care for older adults are really important. And those additional topics are function and functional ability and falls, which is an important clinical syndrome in older adults related to mobility and activity. So by the end of this session, I'm hoping you can describe the terms mobility and function as we use them to think about older adults, and as clinical entities in older adults, describe the benefits of activity for older adults, physical activity, and describe two ways to prevent falls. Yes. Sure. You got to the heart of it, which is I avoid it in the talk. I don't actually put my nickel down because it, frankly, at times moves around in terms of age cutoff. And you'll see that one thing we really try to think about in geriatrics is the physiologic age, not chronologic age. And that's actually where function comes in a lot. So we'll get to that a little bit. But the bottom line is, for most intents and purposes in research and otherwise, 65 and old over is often considered older adults. Long answer. Thank you. So again, I'm going to start off with just giving us some background on the clinical and health entities that are mobility, activity, function, and falls, and how they relate to health. And Loewen is then going to take over and talk to us about ways to assess and improve mobility and function, particularly with an eye on preventing falls, and how to make an activity plan that you can go home with. Again, that's part of the reason for the handout. So really, truly take it or leave it. So my overall organization for the talk is to go through these topics in this order. And just to point out that As I talk about these things, feel free to raise your hand and ask for clarification, but they're just very interrelated, which is why I'm talking about all of them, mobility, activity, and function. They all impact each other greatly and all have very similar relationships to health outcomes. So I think you'll appreciate that as I'm talking. And then finally, falls as a clinical entity sort of impacts all of these things, which is why I'm talking about it at the end and bringing it up in the first place. So mobility. What is mobility? What am I talking about when I'm talking about mobility? I just want to be specific. So, and I'm sure you all in your minds have some notion of what you think mobility is. Clinically, we really define it as being able to go safely, consistently, reliably, where you want to go, when you want to go there, and how you want to go there. That would be the optimal mobility state. You have no limitations in mobility. And it's acknowledged as a key component of healthy aging, to be able to do this. So what is it, what are we talking about when we're talking about mobility disability? And I think immediately you appreciate when you think of that definition of mobility, that a mobility disability is not just reliant on the person. The environment is a big factor in that. So on the one hand, we have people with extreme ability limitations. So they may have limitations in strength, balance, or sensation. Those are pretty common. Or they may have full paralysis below the neck, for example. That's could be a serious ability limitation that limits mobility, being able to go where you want to. But of course, the environment plays a huge role for many of us. And for example, everybody has a mobility disability when they're standing at the bottom of Mount Everest on a snowy day. But of course, things can contribute to mobility disability in many simpler circumstances. And I think here we can all appreciate uneven pavement, hills that may limit our mobility, and I know is a huge factor for some of my patients, and indoor versus outdoor. So people may actually just have a lot of environmental challenges in an outdoor setting more than an indoor setting. And so we call mobility disabilities when there's a gap between these two things, the environment meeting the person's ability or the person's ability meeting the environment. And so much so that this is a key component of the WHO, the World Health Organization, when they design their guide to how to plan an age-friendly city, acknowledging that there's a huge heterogeneity for diversity of abilities in older adults. And the key is really that the city be able to meet those older adults where they're at, or any person, really, in terms of meeting their ability needs. So things like clear paths that you can walk down unobstructed, and that are even, and places to sit if you need to take a rest, things like that. So then clinically, though, where is this coming home to roost? How are we measuring it in a doctor's office, as it were? And really, we're asking questions. We're asking people if they're noticing that they're having trouble. So for health or physical reasons, do you have difficulty climbing up 10 steps or walking 1/4 mile? Or same sort of question, but have you modified that? So if people are saying yes to either two of those, I'm thinking maybe they're having trouble with mobility in the community. So it's fairly simple, and that may seem like a low bar, but it's one that clinically becomes really relevant and important in people's lives if they're having trouble with this. And this is often what's studied, people's ability to climb stairs or walk a certain distance, a relatively long-ish, but not too long distance. And then clinically, of course, again, I'm going to defer a lot of the assessment to Lowen, but just your doctor or healthcare provider may be interested in knowing how your balance is, and if there's any findings on neurologic exam, that can clue us into mobility issues. And if the gait speed is slow, we often, especially in geriatrics, you'll often see tape on the floors because we're measuring people's gait speed as they're walking into the office. And then there's something called the short physical performance battery, which is used in more rigorous settings to look at mobility. And people do things like chair stands, which I still don't fully understand. You're not actually standing on the chair. You're like standing next to the chair. Because I mostly do gait speed. It's a much more practical test. And then tandem or semi-tandem walking, where you're walking one foot in front of the other. Or an 8-foot walk, which is similar to a 10-foot. It's just a different length. And is this something common? Do we need to worry about this? Well, in older adults who are not in long-term care, so in the community, 27% last year reported difficulty walking or climbing stairs. So they met that criteria. So almost a third of older adults. And then we know that there are some very common risk factors. So we know as people get older, they tend to report more mobility impairment. So older age is a risk factor. Lower physical activity over a lifetime, so preceding a mobility impairment, is a risk factor. Obesity, strength or balance impairment, and high chronic disease burden or a particularly severe chronic disease has been associated with mobility impairment. So these are things I'm also looking for to see if my patient may be at higher risk. And then we know it's tightly linked to health and some important health outcomes. So it predicts further physical disability and mortality. So 2 to 3 times increased risk of mortality if somebody has a mobility impairment. And it's linked to lower self-reported health status. So when people are asked what they think their health status is, if they say very good, good, or okay, or poor, or very poor, they're more likely to say poor, very poor. And quality of life. And what's fascinating is a mobility impairment tends to be a stronger predictor of poor quality of life, people reporting poor quality of life, than even a severe physical disease or high medical comorbidity. And then I'm sure it's unsurprising, it leads often to isolation, social isolation, and higher reports of loneliness, as well as depression, higher depressive symptoms. And it's independently, when you sort of compare people who are very similar and one has mobility impairment and the other doesn't, the person with mobility impairment is much more likely to be at risk for nursing home placement. So that was our brief review of mobility and why it matters in the clinical setting. And now we'll talk about what we talk about in clinical geriatrics when we talk about activity. So just a brief background, we do know that physical activity decreases with age. And we do know that as we age, we lose some physiologic capacity in many of our organ and systems that likely contributes to decreased physical activity. Of course, there's always a choice around physical activity, so that is a factor as well. But just to say, a marathon runner, if they continue to run marathons their entire life into their 80s, 90s, 100s, will notice decreased ability to, longer times, things like that. So decreased physiologic capacity. However, the thing, and I spend a lot of time talking to people, my patients about this, is that physical activity has been shown to be beneficial at every single ability level. So we know that as people get older, which is meant to be this, so as people get older, we know their physical function declines. It doesn't mean that they will necessarily become disabled, but it is a frequent outcome. So some people will lose some capacity but never be disabled. But some people will sort of slowly go, as they get older, from high functioning to preclinically disabled to some markers of disability, ultimately to being disabled. But what we know is that at any point, first of all, physical activity is safe. And secondly, that it will change the trajectory of that person's disability and physical functioning. So notice they're not spiking upward and going back to a different baseline, but from wherever they are when they start physical activity, we know it slows decline and further progression towards disability. And then, again, I really spend a lot of time counseling people that we know it improves many chronic diseases. Heart disease and diabetes are probably the two biggest. We know it slows cognitive decline in people who have cognitive impairment and prevents cognitive decline in people who don't. We know that it prevents further disability, as I just showed you, and ultimately the importance there is that it prevents loss of independence in the community. It's associated with improved quality of life and lower mortality. So we've all heard this, but of course, if we could pulverize physical activity, put it in a pill, give it to people, we would do that. And because we talked about mobility, just to point out that we know physical activity is a strong preventer of mobility impairment. So in a study where they followed community-dwelling older adults, 70 and older, for 12 years, half of those people did, in the course of 12 years, ultimately develop some mobility impairment. In this case, it was defined as difficulty walking a quarter mile. But those who had low physical activity had 40% increased risk of walking disability. So what are the recommendations around physical activity for older adults? Well, for all adults, older adults are still part of all adults, of course, 18 and up, avoid inactivity as much as you can. So the most important thing is do not be sedentary, if at all possible. Then the minimum recommendation is 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise a week. And how do you gauge moderate versus vigorous? What I've been taught is on a scale from 0 to 10, if 0 is no effort and 10 is the most effort you could possibly imagine, you're doing moderate activity if you're in the 5 to 6 range and vigorous if you're in the 7 to 8 range. So that is sort of the minimum. And they also encourage you to not do it all at once, to break it up over the week and do it in at least 10 minutes or more intervals. And then also to do muscle strengthening 2 days or more per week. So that is the overall general recommendation. But of course, for older adults, there are some additional recommendations and caveats. And that is, of course, do as abilities and conditions allow. So, and again, emphasizing some activities better than none, for sure. If there is a high risk of falling, and we'll discuss this again, that balance should be incorporated. So not just strength training, but balance training or balance exercises. Start, depending on where that person is in their level of fitness, determine the level of effort in terms of getting started with activity based on that level. And that might be something to work with a therapist, physical therapist probably best, but also a clinician, a medical provider. And then also understand how your chronic conditions might impact your ability to do activity or any restrictions. So obviously heart conditions, diabetes, and neurologic conditions, all these things might be relevant. And then they give examples at health.gov of things that count, as it were, as aerobic and muscle strengthening activities. So for aerobic, walking, dancing, swimming, water aerobics, jogging, aerobic exercise classes, bicycle riding, gardening with a little bit of oomph, so raking or pushing a lawnmower, tennis or golf without a cart, muscle strengthening, things with exercise bands or weight machines, handheld weights, calisthenics that has resistance, the heavy lifting that goes with gardening, carrying groceries, and yoga and Tai Chi, there's some strength building. This will be my first plug for Tai Chi. So Tai Chi has the best evidence for balance and strength and flexibility. So we're big fans of Tai Chi in geriatrics. It has the best evidence for preventing falls. So then function. What do I mean by function? And again, I feel like this is a term that in normal life means, you know, possibly something very reasonable. In geriatrics, we have a very specific definition when we think about function. But why did I stick it in here? Well, for us, it's really a defining feature of what we do because, again, we want to know where the rubber meets the road with all these things, with people's mobility abilities, their activity levels, and their function. So we really care about preserving and restoring function. And again, I'm going to go into that definition. And this is a sentence from Tom Gill, who's one of their sort of national experts in function and disability in older adults. So assessing function, when we talk about it in geriatrics, we're talking about what are called instrumental activities of daily living and activities of daily living. So we'll go through instrumental activities of daily living first. And I don't know how many of you are really into using apps to support your life. I am now completely dependent on many apps. And basically for all the things you see listed here, for helping drive or do transportation, use a phone, shop for food, do your finances, cook, do housework such as cleaning or laundry, or taking medications. These are all considered instrumental activities of daily living. And basically, if you think about it, these are things you need once you need to be successfully independent in the community and interacting with the community. Activities of daily living, on the other hand, are one step sort of more basic. And those are things that if you never left your house, you would need to be independent in to be able to do by yourself, to be safe, and to not need any assistance. So again, instrumental activities of daily living could get a lot of help with that from neighbors, caregivers, or in many cases, social service agencies. But activities of daily living require a more intensive caregiver. So these are bathing, dressing, toileting, transferring, meaning getting from a bed to a chair or a chair to standing, and feeding. If you can do all these yourself, you can likely be independent in your own home. So, of course, as I was alluding to, the implications here when I'm assessing someone's function is what sort of assistance might they need in the community? Do they need help intermittently from a caregiver to bring some groceries and some prepared meals and do the laundry, or do they need potentially a lot more assistance with 24-hour care? Yes?
I'm confused with why taking medications are not under activity-based.
Yes, so sometimes they are. It kind of depends on your philosophical bent. And I would agree that they're basically an activity of daily living. They're pretty critical for most people. Yeah, so I'll just point out that most of these were developed in 1969. And I'm not saying people weren't as critically dependent on their medications then, but we seem to be more so now. But it is. And actually, I always point out that there's no app to actually get the pill in your mouth. So there's plenty of phone apps for the rest of things, but there's no app that will actually get it. So it's basically an activity of daily living. Yes?
Related to that question, in most long-term insurance policies, when you have to not be able to do two or three activities of daily living, would they consider managing medications as one of those basics?
I think they probably wouldn't. Oh, so the question was long-term care insurance, where in order for it to kick in, you need to be what we call disabled in 2 to 3 activities of daily living. Do they consider medications one of those? And I think they do not. But I will Google that while my co-presenter is talking. So when somebody is reporting a difficulty in one of these things, what am I worried about? What am I thinking are some of the things that might be contributing? And these are both risk factors and things we assess when we're trying to figure out why someone's having functional decline. So kind of the rarest, frankly, or the thing you can't do anything about, so less really able to assess are sort of genes or genetic predisposition, sort of physiologic makeup to be, you know, something like a frailty syndrome or something where they're not able to meet their own functional needs. The other really big one, which happens all the time, and I'll re-emphasize this in a minute, is hospitalizations, or medical conditions. So acute medical illness, hospitalizations often will result in a functional decline, and falls is a big contributor to functional decline. Age-related changes, so things that we think of as fairly normal physiologic with aging, so slow, gradual decrease in vision or hearing, can reach a pathologic level that affect function. Medications are also something that can contribute to functional decline. So we're always on the lookout for working on medications. Obviously, that will be a whole topic in and of itself. But we consider some appropriate. The person has the disease, they need the medication, and it just has a side effect that's impairing function. For example, a pain medication that may be causing some somnolence or drowsiness. Or it's actually in a class of medications we would consider inappropriate that really older adults should never really be on, and I'll review some of those. And then the environment. Again, this critical interaction between the abilities and what the person is sort of capable of doing and the environment around them. So things like not having enough support, not having enough money, those can contribute to functional disability, but also the physical built environment around them. So some people can't go shopping because they can't get down and back up their stairs. So what are the health implications of functional disability when we detect it? For us, we are very aware that it's associated with lower life expectancy and worse health outcomes in many conditions. So that's the other reason we really like to know if people have a functional disability, and furthermore, if there's something we can do about it. But just one bit of data here. So if someone is 70 and they're independent in their activities of daily living, their average life expectancy is 16.7 years. If they're mobility disabled, which we've talked about, they have one lower year of life expectancy. But if they have an ADL disability, they have essentially 5 years less life expectancy. And of course, we know life expectancy goes down with age, but the association is the same. So an ADL disabled person who's 85 has a lower life expectancy than somebody who's independent at 85. And the point there is just that, again, this sort of physiologic age over chronologic age, we really want to know physiologically how that older adult is doing, because it's different. That's a different person with a different prognosis. Yes?
That's a lot different than other tables that are usually used. Just based on chronological age, and you already said you're not basing this on probability of study, it's based on chronological age either. And it's like 6 years old, I don't know how, it's a bit more recent. But my point is, there's a difference there. Is it a significant difference between what you see in life insurance tables, for example?
Yeah, so this data is like done over, you know, my apologies for using slightly old data. And the question was if, you know, how, I guess, how robust this information is, or how reliable this sort of finding is. Actually, unfortunately, she got pulled away because of a patient issue, but the course co-director, Louise Walter, who is our division chief, this is her life's work. I really wish she was here to answer it. But her whole argument in the literature is really that function is more important than age, or it's at least a huge factor in age, because basically we do very much think of the robust person at X age, the person with a lot of functional disability, and the person with some limitations but not many, because we know there's many. So this person, for example, the reason this is important is this person, if they have 17 more years on average, of course life expectancy is an average, you don't have a clear prediction for every person, you know that person could very well benefit from a colonoscopy, which should be done once every 10 years, for example. But if that person I actually took out the rows with all the other ages so there wouldn't be too much information. But if that person's 75 and has, you know, is ADL disabled, and at that point has 9 years, you might counsel them that the risks of the colonoscopy are greater than the benefits. So we do really, really very strongly try to contextualize older adults when we see them in a clinical context in terms of how well are they functioning and you know, sort of what how we can either help them or what things are sort of no longer, you know, very helpful because they have, you know, severe you know, impairment and therefore lower life expectancy. So did that begin to answer your question? Okay. I'm sure you'll have another related. But again, so we do really try to assess and think about functional disability because of we know that people who have a functional disability who then get ill and go in the hospitalization are likely to have even worse function. So again, that's just implications for after being hospitalized, needing more care potentially. They're more likely to have a longer hospital stay, more likely to be have a higher rate of institutionalization and risk of readmission, and also higher mortality when in the hospital. So these are my point being, these are highly vulnerable patients when they come into the hospital, and we want to be aware of that. And we want to prevent it as much as possible, prevent functional decline, reverse functional decline as much as possible. So again, I really focus on disease-specific health promotion and physical activity sort of early on, but also if there is a disease-specific reason the person's having a disability, again, vision. The importance of the environment to function and meeting that person where they're at. So I very routinely order home assessments to help with that and to create a rehab plan. work on preventing falls because we know it has an association with worse function. And then hospitalization, this is a key area because it's so tightly associated with more functional decline. In fact, new ADL disabilities in the community that are persistent, about 50% of those came in the context of a hospitalization. And so there are these wonderful new interventions here at UCSF, at the VA, at Zuckerberg San Francisco General. We have something called the Acute Care for Elders Unit, where they have a different approach to people who are older and have functional impairment to help prevent it. And then hospital at home is a model where they're pioneering hospital care in a home setting to prevent some of the complications of hospitalization. Yes, what's your question?
Maybe you can tell us what ADL is.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. That's activity of daily living. I probably should have made that clearer. So when I've said ADL and IADL, I'm sorry about that. Okay. Any questions that are lingering? It seems like yes, there are a lot of points of clarification.
On the life expectancy chart.
Yeah.
You were mixing men and women together, right?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Have you seen any difference?
Actually, it's fascinating. Yeah, so women are, we know, are more long-lived, but they're also more likely to be ADL disabled over the course of a lifetime, and that's even controlling for age. So probably related to some physiologic predisposition, pardon me. Okay, so finally, falls. As I mentioned, this is not in the what we call the normal, healthy circle of supporting an older adult in the community, but instead wreaks havoc, I think, on all of these things, but is a key focus of intervention, prevention interventions in the community. So what is a fall? Again, I'm sort of defining the obvious, but it does have a clinical definition, and that is unintentionally ending up on the ground or other lower level. So to, I guess, make the finer point that you can fall onto a chair or a coffee table, but the point really being that it was unintentional and it wasn't because you fainted or had an acute medical condition that caused you to have sudden weakness like a stroke or that there was an act of man, somebody pushed you, or there was a car crash or an act of nature. So that's what a fall is, and they are very common. I know I see this all the time. I address it all the time in a clinical setting. So we typically say a third of all adults over 65 fall each year, and as people get older, they fall more, so half of adults over 80. And really, this is a critical medical event in people's lives, and it's a big deal. Every 11 seconds, an older adult is in the emergency room because of a fall, and every 19 minutes, an older adult dies because of a fall. It's in the top 10 causes of death, and it's the number one cause of death due to an injury in an older person, and at least 10% lead, apart from death, to major injuries such as fractures. So I think a lot of people hear about hip fractures, but other fractures like arms or long bones. Traumatic brain injury. So at yes, do you have a question?
Does anyone teach you how to fall?
Oh, can I put a pause on that? So the question was if anybody teaches people how to fall. And I will, I think Lowen might be better able to answer that. But just to point out that our main patient profile at Zuckerberg San Francisco General for someone with a traumatic brain injury is an older person who fell. It's not a car accident or... and then hospitalization, obviously, is the result of many falls. And then more importantly, and I know I also see this all the time, is that it takes away what really matters most to people. Obviously, not broken bones matter as well, but people often have a decline in function. So again, over a third. People report decreased physical and social activity after a fall, at least for some period of time. So 15% report both of those things. Fear of falling leads to, is a real clinical entity, and I don't know if anybody knows someone who's experienced this, but it can lead to people being very isolated because they're scared to venture out, depression, and further decline because they're sort of self-limiting mobility. And then in different studies, it's been associated with up to a 10 times risk of needing a nursing home. So even after the fall itself is taken care of, somebody's been to rehab, apart from that, it's associated with increased risk of nursing home. And we know that there are many factors that lead to falls. So we look and we try to address as many as we can. So things that are intrinsic to the person, they have health conditions that contribute to falls, Parkinson's, dementia, these things often contribute to falls. vision and hearing impairments. People are often surprised to hear that hearing leads to increased fall risk, but it does. Age and age-related changes, again, one common change is loss of muscle mass, so that changes often people's balance and mobility. A prior fall, that's the number one highest risk factor for another fall. So we screen for that very aggressively. Things outside of the person, like medications that we've given them that increase their fall risk, and we'll talk about that. Improper use of a device meant to help them with mobility, like a cane or walker. And then the environment. So, again, that's somewhat obvious, but sometimes the environment is too challenging. And all of these things can lead to falls. So medications, I'd love to spend a moment on this because it recently came up again. I feel like I'm starting to not talk about it enough. But the most common medications that we see contributing to falls, the bad actors as they were, number one is benzodiazepines, which are very commonly prescribed, usually for anxiety or sleep. And they are associated with a 60% increased risk of fall, any of them. And these are things like Valium or diazepam, Ativan or lorazepam, Klonopin, clonazepam. Non-benzodiazepine hypnotics, these are other things that we were hoping would be safer than the benzodiazepines, but contribute to fall risk just as much, unfortunately. Ambien or Zolpidem, Lunesta, or I'm not going to pronounce that. That's why I call it Lunesta. Tricyclic antidepressants, which are now less and less used. Actually, sometimes they're used for pain, neuropathic pain, pain related to diabetes. So Elavil is a brand name that you'll hear, but that's amitriptyline or nortriptyline. So these are technically in the class of tricyclic antidepressants. And any antidepressant increases risk of fall, so even the more common ones like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. But these are sort of worse. Anticholinergics, this is a very broad class of medications because we have many what are called choline receptors in our bodies, and they're everywhere. They're in our bladder, our brain. And so there are a lot of medications that target, and surprisingly, even if they don't have anticholinergic side effects, but the biggies, the ones we really worry about are, I should have put it first, but diphenhydramine, that's Benadryl, and that's in a lot of over-the-counter medications, and that's probably where we see it the most, is people are taking something for sleep like Tylenol PM or Benadryl for allergies. Hydroxyzine or doxepin are very strong anticholinergics that are for allergies, and oxybutynin, which is for bladder. Anticonvulsants, so people with a seizure disorder, or sometimes these are used in people with mood disorders, phenytoin or Keppra, levetiracetam. I don't, as a geriatrician, I don't have to prescribe them, so I don't have to say them. Yes?
I don't know if I have an anticonvulsant, but I take a thing called primidone for essential familial tremor.
Yeah. There's so many medications that have these side effects. I often check it against the list, and I will check that for you. And then antihypertensive. So this is somewhat obvious, but they decrease blood pressure. And as such, they decrease your ability to respond to normal physiologic changes in blood pressure you would need if going changing position. So sitting to standing or lying to sitting. And can cause drop in blood pressure when you're changing position and lead to falls. So that's the main mechanism by which antihypertensives do it. And of course, any of them can. And the thing I always remember is that this is a harm reduction strategy with managing falls and fall risk. So more risk factors somebody has, their risk just keeps going up and up. So we don't stop trying to address any risk factor we can find. So somebody with four or more risk factors in the various lists that I've shown you has, in the course of 1 year, has as much as a 78% risk of falling. It's a much higher risk than the general population, which is more like 32%, or somebody with no risk factors who's only 8%. So again, what can we do? Our risk factor modification, is focused on the environment, strength and balance, Tai Chi, Tai Chi, Tai Chi. Assess and correct vision and hearing. I feel like I go on and on about hearing. Rule out low blood pressure drops. So asking your physician, or in my case, reminding myself to check actual blood pressure sitting down and standing up to see if there's a drop while the person's on their medication. Minimizing medication. So the thing I forgot to say is there are some medications that are big, high culprit medications in terms of falls, but also medications that if you have four or more, just simply that number, no matter what they are, is independently associated with increasing risk of falls. And then vitamin D. Vitamin D is a bit of back and forth on the data. It's still, there's still some positive, the trend is still towards positive in older adults who are at higher risk of fall, so who have one or more risk factors. And that's vitamin D, 1,000 units a day is what we usually recommend.
Okay. I think you just said that's a positive. You should take.
Yes, you should take vitamin D. You should take vitamin D. Yeah, especially if you're high risk. Right now, that is still the recommendation. Okay, so thank you guys for your attention. Are there any last questions that I can address before? Yes, please. Okay, so, okay, one more question.
Okay, I was serious about the question because I broke my wrist and my knuckle falling and got the vision problems.
Yeah.
So is there some place you can learn how to fall?
Yeah.
So you won't break your
So this gentleman's asking about how to fall well and safely, because he's himself has experienced a fall. So again, actually, this is a perfect segue to Loewen. And please, I do apologize. We will make sure to answer all questions either during the actual time or afterwards. So I will very pleased to welcome Loewen from physical therapy.
Thanks. But we're going to talk a lot about functional assessment. I will get to talking a little bit about not only what physical therapists like to do to work with people to prevent falls, but also how to control a fall. Obviously, part of that is realizing that you're falling, which is part of the problem with falling is people start falling and they can't catch themselves. When you're younger, you realize you're falling and you take that step, that kind of stuff. But first, I want to talk about how we assess function and just plain staying active and mobility. Again, as providers, we're up here talking about function, but we also get it that you kind of like the first part of that word, that, you know, if I'm trying to get you to motivate yourself to do exercise, to be active, to be mobile, it can't just be so you can cross the street. I want you to get out of bed, I want you to get up from chairs safely, up from the floor, getting out and going shopping, but there's also a lot of fun in activities, and we don't forget that. We just tend not to focus on it when we're talking about clinical stuff. But it is absolutely something that can be super important for you. And motivation is a big part of staying active and mobile. I've given you a picture of some of my sports heroes these days. But whatever motivates you to stay active can be very important. And do talk to that. Do kind of talk to your providers about what you care about. If there's goals that you can set that keep you moving, we're happy to work with that. But we do have to focus on some of the functional stuff. And I can tell you that that not only are most of these people faster than me in the water in our bay, but they also get in the water faster. So kind of swimming in aquatic park is one of those things where you learn that it takes years to get that tough, because it takes me a long time to get in the water. So obviously, whatever you like to do, whether you're competitive, and I can tell you that a lot of these swimmers are very competitive with each other, if you can focus on the health goals, or if you just want to be able to care for other people, if you want to be independent, these are all goals that are very important to staying mobile and staying active. So a little bit, this was recently covered by NPR, but a little bit of research in the news, this was a study done where they took people who were in their 70s and 80s, and half of them got health education, half of them got physical activity prescribed, and usually we think knowledge is power, but in this case, it actually took exercise. They needed power is power. So they did, and again, this was very much in line with the CDC guidelines for activity. They were getting 150 minutes a week of walking for their cardiovascular exercise, but they were also doing strength, flexibility, and balance. And overall, over the course of 2.5 years, they found that the group that, of course, was getting all the exercise managed to stay mobile and stay active, and they defined that as being able to walk that full quarter of a mile. They, of course, did it in meters, but it was something that made a big difference over time. Instead of just getting the edge, instead of just going to courses, you actually have to get out and do it, okay? So one of the ways we do like to assess speed is the 5-meter walk in clinic. And of course, in the U.S., we have a 5-foot starting time, and then you walk 5 meters, and then you have a 5-foot walk off again after that. I'm in physical therapy, so we have a bigger clinical space than my friends who are MDs usually don't have enough space for 16.4 feet of walking space, but we usually test it at a comfortable speed for patients, and we usually give them a few tries in physical therapy, not just walking into the clinic. And then we do some quick estimates of how long that takes someone to walk, because we like to take it in meters per second. But we can see that anything less than 0.4 meters per second means you're pretty much just walking around the house and maybe even using furniture or something at home a little bit faster in your limited community ambulator. I do have some normals at the end of the talk, and that's kind of a normal, comfortable speed for someone who's over 80, is that limited community ambulator speed from around that 0.8 meters per second. Community ambulator, you get up to 1.2, and then above, able to safely cross streets independently and that kind of thing. And you can see that those speeds not only are important for getting around the community, but also have some predictive value for if someone is more likely to be independent with their ADLs, or a little bit dependent on some of those activities of daily living or IADLs as well. More likely to be hospitalized with the slower speeds. Obviously more likely to need more help with fall prevention. If they are hospitalized, that those really slower speeds are more likely to end up going to a SNF, a skilled nursing facility, before you are discharged to home, that kind of thing. And then, of course, down at the bottom, being able to walk in your own home versus in the community versus being able to cross streets and stuff safely. So one of the nice things for gait speed is if your gait speed isn't quite normal, if it's not quite where you want it to be, improving it by just a little bit, by 0.1 meters per second, actually is predictive for improved well-being. And again, this is something you can practice. So speed is something you can practice. Not only do we want you to be safe, that's our first thing in physical therapy, prevent falls. But in general, we want you to be fast enough that you can be safe in your environment and also be able to withstand perturbations in case you get bumped and stuff. I did see a question.
Yes, when you're testing these people, it sounds like you're testing them in a safe environment, that's level.
Yeah, that's
for curbs or broken pavement.
Yeah, for true gait speed, we're giving them a really nice surface, a somewhat controlled environment. You know, usually it's a PT gym, so depending on what else is going on, sometimes I've been playing catch with a 6-year-old sports patient at the same time someone's trying to do this test, which probably wasn't a very fair test. But yes, absolutely, especially for true gait speed, we give them a very safe environment. In the community, not only are there curbs, cracks in the sidewalk, other people walking around, but you also get things moving in your line of vision. And that it can be a big problem with balance as well. So all those things get incorporated into this. This is kind of the most simple and basic assessment that we would do for gait speed. And sometimes we even take people out into one of the quiet halls in our building and do it where there's not a lot of other noise and people around them. And so it's a very controlled environment. And I think some of the things that we're talking about today are talking about practicing something in a very controlled environment, which is kind of like people who stay at home all the time and only practice being at home, which is a very consistent, controlled environment, unless you have pets or something like that, versus practicing variety and being good in multiple situations and being able to kind of handle new things in the environment. So very good point. Another thing that we like to do, a slightly more challenging one instead of just straightforward gait speed, is the tug. So this is a timed up and go. It's a standard test, again, that we have. It's been studied in a lot of different populations, not just people as they get older, but also Parkinson's disease, people who have had a stroke, people who have an amputation and are walking with a prosthesis, that kind of thing. So it assesses gait, but it's also you get the instructions at the beginning and you have to remember what to do. So for some people, it's actually a memory challenge at speed, accuracy, safety, and of course, fall risk. In this one, the instructions are, you're going to start seated comfortably. You're going to stand up without using your hands, walk at a comfortable pace, and we usually measure out a nice 3 meter distance. You have to turn around. You see a little spot on the floor is what we use at the gym for physical therapy. Come right back down to the chair and sit down safely without using your hands. We let people use an assistive device, and we score this one in seconds. So this one is slightly more complicated, right? You have to stand up from a chair. You have to get to a spot. You have to turn around. That's obviously where a lot of people can have problems with their balance. If this isn't challenging enough for people, if we feel like some patients will come in saying, I was fine, and then, one day I was thinking about something else, and I fell. When I turned and I fell. So sometimes we'll do the dual task type testing, where you basically are looking at how much attention it's taking for you to walk with a good speed as well as safely. And we'll do kind of things like making people count backwards by sevens and that kind of thing, which, you have to think about. Strangely enough, we do that when we're swimming in the bay too, to make sure we're not getting cold and not realizing it. But we'll do dual task and see if patients slow down a lot, because sometimes people are distracted. And it also gives a little idea of how much brain power it's taking you to walk safely, because sometimes that becomes important. Other assessments we like to do, sit to stand is how we call the chair stand. It's never standing on a chair. We only do that when it's time to change the clocks in the clinic. And we never test patients on that one, even though we get patients who have done that at home, that's for sure. Sit to stand, actually, there's great research on just standing up and down from a chair. It's obviously a functional movement. It's at the gym, they call it squats, they call it deadlifts. It's kind of those classic strengthening exercises that at the end of the day speak to being able to go up and down stairs, up and down hills, or just get in and out of chairs. You can test how many times you can do it in 30 seconds for a little more endurance. And we usually in clinic just test how long it takes someone to do it about 5 times. But there's actually been research to show, and I didn't cite it here, and I apologize, but that has a pretty strong correlation with overall morbidity and mortality. If someone has a good score on getting up and down from chairs, they actually do better than people who are a little bit slower. And it's leg strength, which is a big predictor of mobility and activity, okay? And then the other one that I can't do particularly well, so I don't make a lot of patients do it, is standing up from a cross leg sitting position on the floor. And it's supposed to be without using your hands, and there was actually studies that came out recently that showed that people tended to live longer if they could get up from the floor without using their hands from a cross-legged position. I can tell you it's pretty comical watching me try to do it, yeah, but I've seen people do it pretty brilliantly. So a little bit about, in addition to this, what can you do about this? And my talk is really, it's kind of ambulatory biased. I'm talking about walking, and not everyone has to walk to be mobile, for sure. Obviously, some people do better getting out and being more social, being able to be more independent, obviously with some kind of a wheel device. But for strength, the two big ones, most people, I think, have, complaints about their knees and that kind of thing. But the two big areas that I want people to focus on strength when you talk about mobility is hips and ankles. Hips obviously control your balance forward and back, but also side to side. They do a really most of the work of keeping your trunk centered over your feet, which we'll talk about a little bit, is what balance is for most people who are ambulatory. Doing things like the squat, the sit to stand, walking stairs, but also sideways walking, sideways kicks, and then bridges are some of the exercises you'll see people doing. I mean, we make people do those in the hospital. So laying down on your back with your legs bent up, lifting your hips up off the ground is a great kind of basic hip exercise that's very important for strength. For ankles, going up on your tiptoes, being able to tap your toes and stretch the ankle the other way, but also some of the higher level balance stuff that's sometimes difficult is walking on the balls of your feet, walking on the heels, and still important for the ankles to do sideways walk. At the end of the day, your ankles pretty much help you balance forward and back. Only if your ankles kind of cause problems do they cause problems side to side, but obviously very important in both directions. Flexibility is another big thing that we think about and assess in physical therapy, but there's also just a couple things you can do on your own. Obviously, when we think of hip flexibility is really important not only for these motions that we're talking about, but also protective for your back. If you're bending over to pick something up and you're bending from your back instead of your hips, not only are you skipping a great big muscle group, your glutes, that are really important for function, but you're also bending and straightening some your spine, which can lead to problems. We want spines to be pretty stable and strong. We want you doing the work of lifting and moving from your hips. They're much more mobile joints. And obviously, you don't they're meant to move, whereas bending and moving in your spine also kind of throws off a lot of other stuff. Knees, you know, you can work on straightening, bending your knees and making sure that you can get them straight. All as well as very important for balance, being able to get both ranges of motion, but usually not too straightforward. As long as you can get a decent bend in your knee and you can get a pretty straight knee, then you're okay. Ankles, the calf stretch, or being able to bend your knees or walk down a step with your knee coming over your ankle, so being able to dorsiflex, which is kind of your foot bending back that way, is actually pretty important for balance. So being able to bring your toes up to your shin, but doing it with your foot on the floor. And then plantar flexion is that toe point position, and being able to have range of motion in both directions for your ankle, obviously for normal gait and mobility. Some of the other things that really pay off from an exercise program standpoint, and these are kind of ways to break down your exercises into very simple components that have a big component to that balance and mobility. So posture is one of the ways also that it's one of the things that, you know, balance as you get older is very multifactorial. Lots of little things contribute to kind of challenges with balance as you get older, and posture is one of them. So if you do have, if you start to develop some postural problems, or, and quite honestly, the older population isn't the only ones having postural problems these days, it can throw off balance, and it can create problems for mobility. So upper back extension and strengthening those muscles, shoulder retraction, alignment, awareness, and endurance are all things we think about when we think about posture. And again, a lot of this is that spinal alignment. This is the stand tall exercise program, and research is a lot of stuff that comes out of research on kyphosis, which is that forward bend in a back. And a lot of it is correlated to osteoporosis, osteopenia, and skeletal health problems. So balance, as we talked about a little bit, you know, I was pushing mobility, mobility, mobility. But balance, obviously, is very important. And we just like to think about it as keeping your center of mass over your base of support. Static balance is the stuff that's easy to test in the clinic, standing on one leg, standing with one foot in front of the other. But dynamic balance is usually the more challenging one, and what causes problem in everyday function is being able to maintain that balance, not only in a changing environment, to your question, to your point about your question earlier, but as you're changing the position of your body. One of the reasons, of course, and it's kind of like putting everything together and making it one reason, we like to talk about it as anticipatory postural adjustments, APA. This is how physical therapists like to talk about balance. But it's multifactorial, and it's kind of your body synthesizing sensory feedback from your vision, from your vestibular system, which is that inner ear system that kind of tells you which way is up, and also from proprioceptive information, and that's your sensation from your body telling you where you are in space, even if you have your eyes closed. So all those systems, vision, vestibular and hearing sometimes, and also proprioception, if you get any kind of a neuropathy or something in your feet, if your sensation's not as good in your feet, obviously you have problems with that feedback coming from your feet. If you have a joint replacement, you no longer get proprioceptive information from parts of your knee that you used to. If you have pain in your knees, you're not getting proprioception, you're getting pain kind of taking over that whole area. So those are all things that go into how you synthesize your natural postural adjustments, which basically means it's a feed-forward mechanism. It's central nervous system processing, which means you're taking in all the information and processing it quickly without thinking about it. And it just means if I go to lift my right foot up off in the ground to take a step, my body automatically shifts my weight over my left leg. And it does that without thinking about it, but if all those little components and all that synthesis slows down a little bit in lots of little ways, it ends up making a big enough difference that you slow down a little bit. And instead of automatically shifting your weight over the side as you pick your foot up, that can stop. And you know, it's postural changes that go into that. It's the decreased sensation. It's the speed with which you process things on your central nervous system. But it's basically like, well, if balance comes from lots of different inputs and lots of different outputs, it's basically saying that those inputs slow down, those outputs slow down. But there's ways you can improve it. And Tai Chi is again, not only the big one that's been studied, but it incorporates shifting weight side to side. It incorporates head movements. And because that vestibular system and your eyesight is so important, one of the things that people get into trouble with is balancing and moving their head at the same time, but also balancing in an environment when things are moving in front of you. You'll see people standing at a bus stop. You know, we always, if our patients are ready for it, we make them practice their single leg balance standing at a bus stop with traffic going by, because your brain's thinking that you're moving to the left if cars are going to the right. But that's your vestibular system and your vision having to process that information quickly and saying, I'm not moving, the world is moving around me, that kind of stuff. Some of that is vestibular and visual processing. But those are all the things. And again, yoga, you get some head movements. It's certainly balance. It's strength related. The exaggerated sit to stand. It's another one that as you stand up from a chair, your head is moving. You're just not doing those side-to-side things that can be confusing for balance as you get older, and at any age, really. And then any kind of dynamic balance exercises that incorporate moving around. And dance is another one that's kind of big. You incorporate moving in multi-directions. You incorporate moving your head, coordinating upper body and lower body. But Tai Chi is the one that is in a very controlled, rhythmic, and repetitive way. You practice weight shifts, strength moves, single leg balance, coordinating upper extremity and lower extremity, and head position movements. So fear of falling, and, you know, I didn't see any research on if fear of falling was highly correlated to going to a talk like this, but now I'm a little worried about it because we have been talking about falling a lot, and hopefully you're getting that I'm talking about mobility first, but also being smart to prevent falls and to fall smart if that's the only option you have. But fear of falling can be an independent risk factor for falls. It's also obviously highly correlated to people decreasing their activity, mobility, and even sometimes social interaction, because they're afraid to go out and try to do more things. So obviously education is a big point of it, trying to plan to prevent falls, trying to have a plan if things go wrong, right? And recognizes when situations deviate from what you usually are used to practicing or used to doing, if you're tired, if you're not feeling well, that kind of thing. But exercising to improve your confidence. So not only are you doing physical training to get smarter, to get more flexible, to get more cardiovascular endurance, but you're also trying to remind yourself that you can do these things without that kind of fear of falling. So being able to practice stuff gives you a little bit more confidence in being mobile, being active. So practicing, again, kind of like our Tai Chi example, those repetitive movements make you learn how to do stuff because you do get more reps. So one of the ways that we do assess fear of falling is the activity-specific balanced confidence scale, ABC scale. It can measure over and under confidence because we worry about the people who are afraid of falling even though they're walking pretty well, and so it's limiting their ability to walk and their desire to walk. But we also worry about those people who don't realize that they're having problems with balance and they're going out and they're doing stuff. They're doing it fast. They're carrying things and that kind of thing. So we worry about both directions. And then it identifies safety risks, but also risk of decreased mobility. And it's the kind of thing where patients do get to self-assess how confident they are. So 100% confidence that they can do something safely to absolutely no confidence that they can do something safely. And it's about 16 questions. Talks about walking around the house, downstairs, picking up an item, a slipper from the floor, reaching out for something when up and overhead, but also reaching out if they have to get up on tiptoes to do it, getting in and out of a car, walking in a busy environment, walking and getting bumped in a busy environment, but also things like holding on to an escalator while they're holding on to the handrail, or going up and down an escalator while holding on to parcels. And again, an escalator is another great example of your head's moving through space, but you're not walking. But your feet are still on the ground. So hopefully in the talk today, we'll also encourage you to assess your everything that goes into balance. Like I said, there's lots of things that you have to think about, but there's also lots of ways that you can get help from healthcare providers. Everything from vision, the big thing that we screen for in physical therapy is people who have bifocal, trifocal, or kind of transitional lenses, and when they're going downstairs and they can't see their feet or they can't see their stairs. Pain is obviously a problem because it limits that proprioceptive feedback that you get from your legs if it just hurts. Continence is a big one, continence is the kind of triple threat of continence is if you wake up in the middle of the night and you have to rush to the bathroom and you have low blood pressure anyway, is trying to jump out of bed with low blood pressure, make it to the bathroom in time. So we do worry about continence, and we talk about training continence to make sure that that is not an issue for falls. Nutrition and hydration, obviously, something that we worry about a lot in lots of our populations, making sure that both are taken care of. Also the medications that Dr. Chodos covered pretty well. And then things like footwear, things like having the right assistive device, but also not being not having a stigma or being afraid to use an assistive device that's appropriate and helps you not only be social, but get out and be more active or mobile. Environment. Some things you can control and some things you can't. Obviously, the big one that we worry about in the literature, right, is icy sidewalks, and you guys have already mostly controlled for that by living out here. So kudos to that. Way to plan ahead. But things like rugs at home, things like, having a cluttered house. I trip over stuff at home just because I should do a better job of cleaning up. But then you know, having the community and having support for an exercise program, you know, having you have a better chance of sticking with mobility and activity goals if you have someone who's encouraging you. And so some of the things, if you are getting coaching about your mobility, or if you are coaching and trying to support someone else, there's just a couple of things on neuroplasticity. Just like strength, you can gain or maintain strength into your 80s, is what the research shows, and probably even a little bit past that. But you can also learn, and that means improving your balance and improving your mobility. Into your 80s as well. Some of the things that we know about feedback is if someone is constantly telling you what to do, you actually don't learn all that much. Like if you're just, I'm just going to do my exercises when I'm in physical therapy, because that's when my physical therapist coaches me to do it right. You actually won't learn it as well. You can learn how to do things in physical therapy, but you also have to have the confidence to try stuff on your own, because that's where you do a lot of the learning. Practice without the feedback is important, but also practicing variety. It kind of goes back to the, you know, if you have one chair at home that is your most comfortable chair to practice getting up and getting out of, you'll be really good at getting out of your home chair, but you may not be good in different environments. So you do have to practice different chairs. You have to practice different environments. To your point, if you want to be out and about in a complex community, you have to practice complex situations. External cueing is often a little bit better than focusing on the body part. So if someone's, you know, in physical therapy, sometimes you'll hear people say, all right, right foot, take a step with that right foot. And sometimes it's actually a little bit better to say, okay, I'm going to walk to that tree, or I'm going to walk there. And that helps you get a little bit faster by focusing on the environment. Obviously, the big place that we see that is that's kind of one of the classic features of Parkinson's disease, is you can step over a line on the ground, but you can't just make yourself take a step, that kind of stuff. So having goals, focusing on performance, can increase motivation and improvement. So if you know how fast your gait speed is, it actually helps you get a little bit better by having that goal of where you are, but also where you want to be. And then goals with metrics obviously help to improve performance. So this is one of my PTs that I work with. If you're afraid that you will fall, it's tempting to not walk at all. Stay strong and stay fit, and for gosh sakes, don't sit. Get up, get moving, stand tall. And I probably could have just put that up at the beginning and you would have gotten it all. But I have some normal gait speed, so if you guys want to get competitive, you can compare yourself to others. And also some scores on the timed up and go if you really want to get competitive. But what I do want to encourage everyone to do, and I do want to make sure that you have a good sense of being safe if stuff does not go as planned, but making an activity plan. So kind of from our list of things that we threw out today, if you would kind of think about prioritizing, what are the things that maybe you need to get help with versus what are the things that you need to work on? So what issues do you feel like you need to kind of get an assessment? You know, practicing is not going to help your vision necessarily. You need to go get an eye exam. Trying to figure out pain control. Obviously, I'm a physical therapist. I think exercise is the best thing for pain control, but there's a lot more out there. But we're trying to encourage people tonight to think about, and if it's not for you, for someone else, or for, you know, or for having kind of a team goal, if you can get some people who are also interested in this, is kind of thinking about what is a short-term goal around incorporating and increasing activity into your life that you can do in the next week or two, but also what is a long-term goal. So if you have goals that you would like to achieve in the next 3 to 6 months, how can you add some short-term goals into your life to get there in the next 6 months? And you can have kind of those like, well, I don't want to fall in the next 2 months. But you can also have goals like, well, in order to do that, I'm going to practice getting in and out of my chair 10 times every morning or something like that. So they can be activity-based goals, they can be prevention goals, or maybe they can just be knocking off some of the things on your checklist about, like, I do need to go get my vision checked. You know, I do need to talk to my doctor about continence or something like that, and I haven't wanted to talk about that before. So Dr. Chodos also has some great recommendations for guidelines for activity. Obviously, there's an awful lot of great information on the internet. There's a lot of other information on the internet as well. But the NIH, the CDC, there's a lot of kind of great information that's available. And these slides hopefully will be available. And also the local stuff that we have, not only Parks and Rec, that does have a Tai Chi program. If you are just tired of us talking about Tai Chi, I know that we also have Qigong here at UCSF. There's senior centers both at Golden Gate Park and throughout and the city, and then adult day programs, obviously. So hopefully you guys will have these in the packet. Do you want to come up and do some of the other resources?
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I put these up here. And I don't know how many of you sort of feel comfortable going to the web for these things, but these were just a few I wanted to recommend. So health.gov, NIH has a senior health focus, and NIA Go for Life is a National Institute on Aging focus on physical activity. So they have ways to get you started really concretely, as Loan was saying, with sort of an activity plan. So that's why I recommended that one. And then we have so many activities, and many of them are completely free. The one comment about the adult day programs is those are actually for people with disabilities and activities of daily living, or ADLs. So those are for people who have more limitations. You sort of need that to qualify, because they're sort of full day programs. And then there's the National Council on Aging has a lot of great resources on falls prevention, including medications that you might want to take a look at. And there's the CDC has a program called STEADY, Stopping Elderly Accidents, Deaths, and Injuries. And for that program, they also have a lot of good resources on falls prevention, including like a home safety checklist and things like that. And then some interesting programs here in the city. So there's a program called CHIPS that will can help you set up a home evaluation. Rebuilding Together will help, particularly helps low-income non-older adults and older adults in the city with repair and renovation at home. And they have a Safe at Home program doing home safety assessment. And then if anybody's a meal or works with anybody who's a Meals on Wheels recipient, they have a program for home safety as well for their meal recipients. And that was it. Those are all the resources. And I agree, we need to make these available. If you feel you have an urgent need for this information, we are happy to email it to you. You can email us at the OAC@UCSF.edu. But that's all the information we have. But we'd love to take some questions. And I'm hoping there still are some. Yes?
I would just like to recommend Kezar Stadium. There's a senior boot camp, and it does everything you said.
Oh, great. Senior boot camp at Kezar Stadium. Thank you. Okay, quarterly boot camp.
Sounds like.
Pardon?
That could be a great short-term goal.
It's running up and down the stairs.
Running up and downstairs.
Pardon?
Is there a schedule?
Yeah, well, if you go on the internet, you can find it. It's every Thursday morning. If you want to drop by.
I'm sorry.
Nobody ever takes a roll. So. Not 9:30. Every Thursday morning.
All right, 9:30 Thursday morning. See you there. That's 2 days from now. Yes, ma'am, over here in the blue shirt.
Could one please demonstrate how to fall safely?
Oh.
Yeah, and it does,
she's got a ways to go.
Yeah, there's. I mean, some of it. You know that I didn't give myself enough time. So, but some of the it is some of the big thing we worry about is. Obviously, knowing when you're falling, so that's having anticipatory postural adjustments, but taking that first step. So one of the things that I didn't talk about today is agility, and being able to take quick steps with your foot, and then being able to catch yourself with your leg. It's better to catch yourself with your leg than catching yourself with your hand and potentially breaking your radius or your wrist, not catching yourself with your hand and hitting your head is the big one that we worry about, right? Tai Chi is a great example, again, of being able to take a wide step out So, but we will talk about that a little bit. But first things first is you want to catch yourself with a foot or your leg. And so that means that squat balance, it's almost a single leg squat balance, being able to have your foot fly out, catch you, and then accept your weight into a squat position. And that's much better than catching yourself with a, foosh is what we call the fall on outstretched arm, because it often breaks shoulders, it breaks hands, it breaks all kinds of things. And then all of that is better than hitting your head.
Sounds like there's a demo after the session. Yes, the woman in the back.
Yes, hearing. Can you say how hearing impacts fall risk, please?
It's honestly, I can't draw a straight arrow. It's just the data has shown that it's been associated, and we think it's just actual general sensory function that you need your senses to be able, kind of what Loan was saying, all these inputs add up to good balance and safe mobility. And so we think it's part of it. It's also critical to brain health overall, and so that may be another factor. Yes, the woman with the gray sweater. Sorry.
You said that getting out of a chair, you test it without using supports. Is that also true as a practice or exercise for going up and down stairs?
So the question was, if you get up from the time get up and go test from a chair without using your arms to push off, and if that's also part of the exercise, that's what you're asking, I believe.
And I'm talking about going up and downstairs.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, going up and downstairs without arms.
Yeah. I think it's one of those differences of how we test stuff versus how we counsel people to do it in real life, is if you have a rail, use it. I don't think there's anything wrong with using a rail. I don't want you to need it. So I want you to practice in a controlled situation, that kind of thing. But it's also like, I do fine going up and down stairs every day until I'm carrying groceries, because then you can't use the rail. So it's great to train yourself again for being able to carry something and go upstairs. It's great to not need the rail, because that means your legs are stronger, your balance is better. That being said, I use a rail when it's available to me. And even if you're not relying on it, it's there. It should be sturdy. Make sure you have sturdy rails available to you whenever possible. And I think that's an important kind of key, is practice in a controlled situation, not needing it. And then use it otherwise, especially if you're not thinking about the fact that you're going up and down stairs. If you've got other things on your mind, use the rail.
Unfortunately, we have one more minute, so we will take one more question. The gentleman in the black coat, who I know you've had your arm raised for quite a while.
A bit about the impact of hospitalization and falls on functional decline. Given that hip fractures are so common, can you talk about the impact of anesthesia on functional decline, particularly memory-related functional decline, and if that's often temporary or more often long-term?
So that's a great question about anesthesia, given the fact that falls usually result in injury, which would likely result in potentially exposure to anesthesia for an operation, perhaps related to a hip fracture. I have to say, I'm not intimately familiar with the data. I will say the general consensus is that most anesthesias do not have long-term cognitive impact. So it's probably other things related to the injury or what led up to the injury. But we'll leave it there. I'm going to stay, and I'm really happy to answer questions. Really look forward to seeing you at future sessions. And we're so thrilled for your engagement and your participation. Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.